But I finally found some guy on a forum somewhere, and he agreed to send me some Bitcoin in exchange for like a money order. A month or two later, that like the price dropped like 70% or something like that. I think I sat on it for maybe 2 or 3 months and then just deleted the wallet. Like I just went, whatever, this is a scam. I'm not playing with this magic internet money. And I just went and dumped all my money in gold and silver and went, oh my God, I've been wrong about this for a long time. Like I've really screwed up.
Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Way podcast. I'm your host, Michael Jordan. Today on the show, we have Daniel White, who has a background in law and public safety. One of our guys on the team, Rick Messett, our chief marketing officer, met him in Prague and he came highly recommended by Rick. And we cover a range of subjects from some new freedom technologies to Daniel's legal perspective on some things, including the legislative state. We talk about Bitcoin, where it's going, and the implications of November's election on some of his thesis related to Bitcoin and his expectations over the next 12 to 18 months. So it was a very fun conversation. I hope you enjoy it as well. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got Daniel here with me today. Daniel, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it, man. Happy to be here.
Yeah, like I told you offline, our CMO here at the Bitcoin Way, Rick Messett, introduced us and said great things about you. I know the two of you had the chance to meet in Prague, and he said it was one of the most interesting conversations he's had with another Bitcoiner. So excited for where the conversation may go, and there are as we've discussed, many directions, but let's start with your background. Tell us what you do for work and what brought you into sort of the public safety sphere.
Well, I manage a regional detention facility up in Northern Oregon, and my path here is super circuitous. Like I mean, if I trace you back, it depends on how far you want to go back into the world, but back when rocks were still soft, if you had met me when I was like in high school or something like that, you know, you would have met a very different person. So it wasn't until my like late 30s that I actually started law school. And oddly enough, I started law school because I was in couples therapy. Like this is going to sound ridiculous. But up to that point, I had basically been like a high school dropout. And, you know, my girlfriend at the time and I were having a bunch of problems. We were seeing some like $250 an hour therapist, and I think it was Sherman Oaks or something like that down in Los Angeles. And she said, you guys don't really need a therapist. You guys just need to grow up. Like, and she pointed at me and said, look, man, your whole life, you've just been like, you know, fighting against your parents by like dropping out of school and not, you know, doing something with yourself. You need to go accomplish something. And so I kind of looked at different educational opportunities and, you know, like looking at becoming a biologist or something. I was just like, ugh, I don't, you know, but I found the law school down in California and I thought, oh, this might be kind of fun. And so that was literally it. I put zero thought into it. I just kind of had this idea like, hey, lawyers make money. I'll go be a lawyer. I don't know. I'll just study that and see what happens. And that led to, you know, a lot of growth on my part. Like I actually, she was right 100%. I needed to grow up, and I actually did kind of grow up through that experience. And, you know, when I got to law school, it was a little bit of a struggle at first, but then as I got a law professor, I started one law school, went to another one, and then, the new guy was just an outstanding educator. I mean, he was just really, really good at sort of boiling some of these concepts down and really helped me orient towards not only getting through law school, but graduating. And from there, I sort of discovered I had like a penchant for legal research and things like that. And I signed up for a master of laws program down at Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego. It's kind of gained some ill repute lately, but at the time it was a pretty decent school. And from there, I went on and did another research degree at the London School of Economics and Political Science. And that's, I originally had been accepted to the LSE in political economy. But a lot of the courses they had on offer, they didn't offer when I got there. So I was a little disappointed in that. And then I met a criminology professor there. And this guy was absolutely brilliant. He's Professor Tim Newbern. He's sort of I think he's heading up the social policy department there now. So I switched career tracks and kind of went into the criminology department. And then from there, I moved to Oregon and took a job as a correctional officer of all things. So I came in as like this super overeducated, you know, boffin guy, and started working the floor in a prison. And from there, I've kind of leveraged my way up, and now I run this facility. So it's sort of a quirky life path, I guess. I guess you could call me a late bloomer, but that's how I ended up going through all these little twists and turns and ending up in the correctional system.
Well, I'll tell you what, that's the best therapist I've ever heard of. First of all, just say it like it is and get you on the right track. We're going to come back to a handful of things you said, but cool. Why don't we talk a little bit about what brought you into Bitcoin then, more specifically?
Well, see, that's kind of the cool thing is, like, as I kind of grew up, I was raised in a libertarian household. Like, my dad was a hardcore libertarian guy. He had like a picture of Ayn Rand on the wall. Like, he was that sort of dude. I think he was probably more like on the autism spectrum than anything else. But I was introduced to these sort of sound money concepts and things like that from a very young age. Like, you know, at like 10 years old, I was talking about we need to ban the post office and stuff like that. Right. So I was already kind of a quirky kid. And, you know, for those who aren't familiar with being a quirky kid, it's not conducive to being popular. But, you know, I mean, it was all through like high school that I was still like, I was already looking at things like Ludwig von Mises and his work and stuff like that, even in high school. So by the time it was like getting into the 90s, I was going around telling people about sound money and people just, you know, disregarded me as a loon. But so when it got around like the financial crisis, my father had passed away and I was looking at investing gold and things like that with some of the insurance money and things that were coming back. And I heard about this Bitcoin thing and I started researching Bitcoin and going, oh man, this is pretty cool. This is kind of this libertarian thing. And, you know, and so it was very, very early on. And I tried to figure out how to mine Bitcoin at the time. And I just couldn't wrap my head around it. Like I kept trying to, you know, unpack these, you know, these little repositories and trying to figure out how to get that mining thing to work. And I had an old laptop at the time and it just wasn't working for me. But I finally found some guy on a forum somewhere. And he agreed to send me some Bitcoin in exchange for like a money order. You know, I mean, that's how sort of archaic this was at the time. And I remember going back and forth with the guy going, well, how do I know you're going to actually send it and this and that? And the guy finally was just like, look, dude, either send or not. I don't care. And it was probably like $100 or something like that. And so I got the Bitcoin. And it wasn't a month or two later that like the price dropped like 70% or something like that. And in my little academic brain, I went, oh, that's the scam. You just sell this thing at a high price and then I get it and it just dumps. So I give you a bunch of money for something that just goes away. And I think I sat on it for maybe 2 or 3 months and then just deleted the wallet. Like I just went, whatever, this is a scam. I'm not playing with this magic internet money. And I just went and dumped all my money in gold and silver. And then of course, you know, you watch the price rise and all this kind of stuff. And I kept, you know, through it all, it wasn't until 2016 I came back and I was writing a paper on anti-money laundering for the Banking Law Journal. It was like a 4-part series I did for them right at the end of my Master of Laws program. And I did a little, like about 3 pages I devoted to Bitcoin, but I still kind of regarded it as like, you know, just, it was just a nothing burger to me. And I was sort of in the Peter Schiff mindset of like, there's no intrinsic value to this and what. Why would I do this instead of like God's money and, you know, gold and silver and stuff like that? And it wasn't until about 2020 that I finally kind of got back into it, but I was more like a shit coiner at the time. You know, I was kind of looking at all crypto and I didn't really draw the distinction until relatively recently, probably about 2 years ago, where I finally set aside all my biases. I set aside all my little academic, you know, arguments that I would make in my own head. And I really just devoted some time and effort and energy to really understanding what Bitcoin was, what it represents, and what it's becoming. And that was that sort of aha moment when I went, oh my God, I've been wrong about this for a long time. Like I've really screwed up. And then since then, I just sort of transformed and went full on. Everything I own is basically in Bitcoin. Like I own, you know, I'm like the quite literal maximalist guy that has like an old shitty used car and like every spare dime goes into the Bitcoin experiment. And that's sort of where I'm at now. But yeah, all these stories I feel like are super long and boring.
No, it's always interesting. What was for you, do you remember, was there like a concept that clicked that was the aha moment? I mean, I know it's always a culmination. And it's like a slowly then suddenly when it comes to your education. But was there like a thing that you maybe connected it to some of the ideals that you had as a libertarian, as a small government type of person where you said, okay, this is real?
Yeah. I mean, embarrassingly enough, like I was writing a little like blog thing on Medium And I was talking about crypto, like shitcoin stuff most of the time. And I had seen an interview with Michael Saylor, and I wrote an article like sort of poo-pooing on Michael Saylor and like, this guy's a moron kind of thing. And I mean, just looking back on it, it's super embarrassing. It's like just the arrogance of the position I was taking and just going like, hey, here's this guy who's clearly devoted a lot of time and effort and thought, and he's clearly a very highly intelligent person. And I was just willing to dismiss it out of hand and write this little article just going, I know what's better than this guy. You know, I mean, it was so dumb and arrogant and silly. But I finally went back and I listened to the entire Saylor Breedlove series. I just said, you know what, I'm just going to, and I sat down like I kind of binge watched it like it was Netflix or something. And I just sat there and watched all 10 or 12 episodes, whatever it was. Excuse me. And it was somewhere in the middle of that that I went, oh, okay. Yeah, it's sort of making a lot more sense. But the thing that I'm actually writing a book right now. I'm just about to finish it up. I've probably got, you know, just probably 65,000 words or put to paper already. I just need to kind of wrap up the last little piece of it. But that sort of outlines my whole thing about what I think Bitcoin does and how I think it helps everybody sort of in the long run. And, you know, I think a lot of people right now are very sort of, you know, doom and gloomy about the future. I'm actually kind of different. Like I think Bitcoin is kind of like an antidote to a fiat cancer, you know, and the way I think it's permeating through the system right now, I think this becomes a thing that sort of self-corrects because it's such a unique, novel invention in the history of mankind. Like there's never been anything like Bitcoin, like an inalienable property right that is not issued by a sovereign, is not protected by a sovereign. I think is such a fundamental and monumental change just to the system we have writ large. That is the thing that most attracted me to the Bitcoin experiment. And I keep calling it an experiment. I think it is a thing that is rock solid and moving forward. And yet in the, you know, if you talk about 5,000 years of recorded human history, it's pretty novel. I mean, it's a 15-year slice out of that. And so it still remains to be seen like how this all plays out. But, and you know, there are enormous forces aligned against that kind of thing. But in terms of the libertarian ideals and things like that, you know, one of those core tenets is the ability to own property. And throughout recorded history, that's been a sovereign protected right, you know, and, you know, like anything else, those promises are only as good as the paper they're put on. And the sovereign routinely abuses those sovereign property rights all the time. I mean, here in the United States, everywhere around the world, they just can come in and take your property. And Bitcoin changes that equation fundamentally. So it's kind of there that really sort of locked in for me and made it a very sort of tangible thing. Jason P. Lowry's book had a little bit to do with that. There's a lot of people kind of poo-poo on his ideas as well. But there is that egalitarian access, zero trust property right that I think is pretty monumental. I don't know how well it works as like a weapon or whatever Jason was sort of putting forth. I mean, I think the kid's really smart. And I certainly don't want to degrade anything he's come up with. And yet, I think there are some aspects of that that are pretty profound. And that was sort of that combination of those two things really sort of shifted my brain.
Yeah, I never understood the animosity toward Jason Lowry's thesis. I started the reading it, and it's long, and I think I just got distracted. But every time I'd hear him on podcasts, for me at least, and maybe it's just like the way people sort of, you know, zoom in on what Bitcoin is to them and and their thesis on how it's going to play out and what's going to break in the world that's going to foster in broader Bitcoin adoption. But for me at least, it always clicks. So I think that's I wouldn't be surprised if in the future we look back on that as like an important document for a lot of how the game theory happens. It's been a while since I've visited the subject though. And that's a guy who's done his research. Speaking of research, you mentioned doing a lot of research. I read some of your papers. You talked about anti-money laundering, police candidate screening, reforms on drug policy. It seems like you're pretty prolific in the writing and the sort of research you've done. Could you like summarize maybe how you think about these topics? Like what makes these sort of cohesive topics to the extent that they are, and what inspires, you know, your interest in those particular subjects?
Well, I think a lot of it, if I trace back, like, you know, like I said, I was sort of, I grew up as kind of a nerdy kid, right? And so there was a pretty substantial portion of my life that was trying to figure out like what it is about people that, or what it is about my interaction with the rest of the world that makes me less popular or something like that. And so there, I spent a great deal of time just sort of unpacking ideas about how people interact, how societies interact with each other and things like that. And so it's taken me on these long historical journeys through everything. All of those papers, if the one coherent sort of narrative between them all is that I take a modern concept and people will debate things in the modern context, like just endlessly. And they can find all kinds of points and positions that they can dicker on about the particulars of what's happening in the modern world. I always trace it back and go, well, where did this idea come from? You know? And even when it came to the book I'm writing right now, you know, as I look back at, like, if you trace through history, people say, oh, you know, warfare has always been there or something like that, for instance. And they'll talk about things, but history almost always starts where the written word starts documenting history, right? And people and the historians are trying to parse through that, but they'll talk about things like, oh, well, you know, this empire invaded this empire and this, and I was always sort of stuck with this idea like, well, what was there before the armies? Because they didn't just spring into existence. Someone didn't just come up and build a castle and like overnight. And then the next week they go, I'm the king. This is how the rules go. And I was always fascinated by how that sort of system developed. And it was the same thing with my paper on anti-money laundering. It was the same thing with my paper on bankruptcy. Like the bankruptcy paper went back to, you know, laws and rules that were written in the 1200s. And that was a sort of fascinating thing about the study of law is like, from a historical standpoint, what the study of law teaches you is how people have been navigating conflict for close to 1,000 years now, and especially in the English common law. And it's a very different narrative than what you see presented from like an economics history or even like a world history or, you know, European history or American history kind of thing. And so it's that idea of like, I want to get to the source of like where some of these ideas come from, where people start forming these associations, where these rulemaking systems come from. And that's always been my sort of fascination with the world is understanding on a deeper level, like how people actually interact and why and where these structures come from. So that's kind of the guiding thesis on all the research I did. But I also think that made it a lot more appealing. Like one of the experiences I had in my Master of Laws is I went to publish a paper. And there was a professor that was sort of pushing me to do that. He said, hey, man, your writing's pretty good. You should try. And he had told me a story about he had submitted his legal research paper to like 100 different law reviews and got rejected by all of them. And then wrote another paper the following year, sent it to the same 100 law reviews. And like number 98 or something finally said, yeah, we'll take your paper. And he's like, oh, my God, this is amazing. And he sort of did a victory lap. And because it's really hard to get kind of published as an academic. And then he went back and resubmitted his first paper and, you know, that he finally got another acceptance because he had already published something is sort of the idea behind that. And then I submitted a paper that I had written as just part of my term. And I said, oh, I'm going to submit this. And I submitted to like 20 law reviews or something like that. And then it got published right away. And so I went and told my law professor, I said, hey, man, I got my first paper published. He said, oh, that's amazing. That's so incredible. It took me forever to get this. And then I submitted another paper and that got published right away. And then the third one, and you could kind of see, I mean, he was very supportive, but there was also that moment of just like, are you joking right now? Like, how are you going through? And like, it took me forever to get my first two and you've already published like three or four. And then I had that 4-part series in the Banking Law Journal. It was just sort of all game. But the same thing happened at the LSE. Like my, you know, I was already publishing book reviews and stuff in the middle of my term. And I had that peer reviewed paper on police candidacy and the police screening apparatus that got published straight away. But I could see other academics like the professors, the PhDs, because for them it's publish or die. And they really sort of struggle with that. And I think owing partly to my sort of historical analysis of things and where things come from, I think it gives people better context. And that in turn leads to, you know, sort of a novel approach to things that make it kind of helpful to get me over the line in terms of publication and things. So that's my thesis. I don't know, but It seems to have worked so far, you know.
Yeah, well, no, you're a fantastic writer. I'm excited to get a copy of your book when it comes out. But something you hit on in sort of the way you approach it is thinking more historically. Like so much of what we know today and assume to be normal has really been more of an emergent, are tend to be emergent phenomena. And it's funny, just last night I was having this sort of a banter with my sister, who is not a Bitcoiner, hasn't gone down the rabbit hole to any extent. And I had used the term evil to describe many of the powers that be, central banks. And she was cautioning me against, using that terminology. And I told her, I said, I think there's just a knowledge asymmetry here. And it's because most people are born into this world and they think that this is just how the way things are and have always been. And it's right. Yeah. It's normal or whatever. And this isn't, I say this humbly, because 2 years ago, I didn't know any of this stuff, but you start to backtrack, and it wasn't until 1913, we had we've had a longstanding central bank in the United States and, obviously more have sprung up globally. But it's like an assumption that that's just something you have to have. Right. And so I think it's interesting to hear you talk about like what were there before the armies, the militaries were fighting and clashing.
Yeah.
So I'm interested to hear your take on a few things as someone with a legal background. Well, first of all, I told you offline that I spent almost a decade in, software sales and selling to attorneys. And my experience, there are a lot of great people. So this is no knock on any individuals. They tend, from my, experience, tend toward more, socialistic ideals. And, it's probably just a more left leaning bunch. Was that your experience? And was there any temptation to sort of migrate that direction? I know you were raised with more libertarian ideals, but was there like ever social pressure around you, or were you sort of in a supportive community of the ideas that you brought to the table?
Well, first, thank you for the compliment about my writing. I appreciate that. That's very kind of you. And in terms of like the social pressure and things, I actually just posted on Twitter today in response to Peter St. Ange, like some video he'd posted about Kamala Harris. The reason I was able to afford that $250 couples therapist way back in the day as a high school dropout is I sort of stumbled into the entertainment industry. Like I worked in film and television post-production and production for close to 15, 16 years or something like that. And that's not an industry where you can like go to school to figure it out. Like you just kind of have to get in and work your way up. And that was precisely what I did. And so by the time I was in that therapist's office, I was commanding a pretty significant salary, especially for a high school dropout. I mean, like a six-figure kind of thing. And that was back when six figures actually meant something, or at least meant more than it does now. And what I can remember is being surrounded by a culture that was just reflexively and sort of mindlessly sort of in that left-leaning socialist kind of mindset. And it, not so much in terms of pressure, but like you would meet people that worked in the entertainment industry that you could call like closeted Republicans. Like they could not come out and say, hey, I'm all about being a Republican or I have conservative values, because it would be so detrimental to their career. But the people that are sort of supporting it, they only do it because they're just sort of herd following. They're not really, like doing this because they believe in it or have any sort of deep held beliefs. They just know everyone else is doing it and they just don't want to get left behind and they don't want to get socially ostracized. So I found that I had to moderate a lot of that. And even working in the criminal justice system, there's a lot of moderation, self-censorship that you almost have to engage in. But if you're in corporate America, you're sort of embroiled in the same conflicts and, whether it's from the HR department and everything else, it can be, there's a lot of sort of just permeated pressure. But it's been going on for a long time, right? Like starting in the 80s, they started with this whole sort of like politically correct speech and things like that. And this is just sort of the culmination of what that ends up looking like. So yes, in a way, and yet I was also that standout. I'm sort of that iconoclastic person that will just stand there and kind of stand up to some of this nonsense. And I would try and introduce people to libertarian principles. I actually marched through the city of Santa Monica with the Ron Paul campaign back in the day. And I remember thinking at the time, I don't even know what I'm marching for, but I just wanted to support Ron Paul. And it was nice to be around sort of like-minded people. I ran for office as a libertarian in 98 in a Democrat-controlled district in Burbank, California. And it was just odd just having those conversations. And I basically got regarded as just that quirky libertarian guy. Like, no one ever took any of it seriously. I think people are starting to see now, like, hey, some of these principles are far more important modernly than they may have given some weight to in the past. Whether that gives anybody cover in a blue state to sort of navigate through that and kind of come out, so to speak, as having even what I would consider moderate values today, because what passes for, you know, like some of this liberal quote unquote leaning stuff is so far left now, it's extraordinary. And, you know, I think a lot of sort of notable personalities have voiced these same concerns, like Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone fame. He won awards for his coverage of the 2008 bank bailouts and things like that. He was the darling of Rolling Stone. And now he's a pariah. They call him a, you know, far right wing extremist and, you know, some Trump supporter and this and that and the other thing, just because he dared challenge some of the media narratives. Glenn Greenwald is another one who's a lifelong sort of left-leaning Democrat. Now he's a pariah because he's not supporting the state party line. Elon Musk has just said recently he's natively a sort of a left-leaning guy. But and I think he nailed it pretty well. He said, "I didn't leave them, they left us," you know, and they've sort of gone down a very different path. So for me personally, I've always been sort of a stalwart defender of it, and I think to some social detriment, but I've managed to navigate it well enough that it hasn't impacted me too much politically in terms of my work and things like that. But yeah, it's definitely a weird pressure that's out there right now. So
yeah,
I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah, no, it does. And by the way, I got cut off for a minute, so I missed probably 30 seconds, but I was probably just frozen on your screen. So hopefully we'll be able to just snip this together. It's still recording.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to ask you a bit about was, you know, as someone with a legal background, do you have like, so like, I know you wrote about anti-money laundering. And how it's, you know, I think part of the thesis of your work was anti-money laundering has become more about compliance than it is preventing money laundering from taking place.
Oh, yeah.
And my sense is that's sort of the nature of a lot of the legal and regulatory, you know, sphere. And maybe there are good intentions when some of these are passed down, but at the end of the day, it becomes just like and this is my experience working in the private sector in sales, selling compliance solutions for people, right, is they're just trying to check a box, really. And, you know, at the end of the day, they just need to, it's a CYA exercise. Like, if they show up and they ask questions, here's what we did. Do you have other examples of like where that happens and maybe what some of the implications are for the broader economy?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, well, to your point, and with the question you asked me earlier about attorneys and them being sort of left-leaning and things like that, the problem with the study of law is when you go through and you start parsing out like an argument and in a legal context, it's you end up like a judge by their nature has to look at both sides equally, right? And most people, when they come to an argument, they go, here's my position, this is what I feel about things, this is what I think about things, and this is the way it is. And inevitably, between any conflict, there's always two sides to it. And so there's a reason why attorneys are super annoying, because they go, well, it could be, you know, like they never will let you pin down an answer, because there's always some variable in there somewhere that makes it really hard to sort of get through like why that rule is there, what the intention was behind the rule. And they debate about this stuff endlessly. One of the beautiful things about the American justice system is that we have this massively decentralized distributed system of judges and then appellate courts and then the Supreme Court that kind of helps everybody navigate through these problems. So when it comes time to like passing a law, like an anti-money laundering law or something like that, or any sort of thing that requires some sort of compliance measure, there's generally speaking some reason behind it. And in the case of anti-money laundering laws in particular, there back in the 1960s, if you saw the genesis of this thing, there were these guys on Wall Street that would go get a numbered Swiss account. The Swiss bank would pool all of their money and then invest it in the stock market, right? But since these are numbered accounts and they have these really strict Swiss privacy laws, nobody knew who was making money off the investment. So they would get all their stock market gains, and then all that would get distributed in the bank back to the account holders, the numbered account holders. And Uncle Sam figured out somewhere like, hey, wait a minute, you guys are getting all these stock market gains that we can't take a slice of. We need to cut down on that. And so they started the Bank Secrecy Act. They wanted to find out who was sending money overseas and where it was going. And it was all just trying to prevent Wall Street guys from avoiding taxes. But the thing is that once you start down that path, the genesis of the thing was like, hey, we're trying to prevent tax avoidance. But what it ends up becoming is this Leviathan sort of financial privacy busting apparatus that we have today. And, you know, what a lot of people don't realize is like the Financial Action Task Force, the 40 recommendations from them, they tried to pass that in the United States in 1998. And once people found out, like, you know, the bank was going to be asking you questions and know your customer and all this suspicious activity reporting and all this and turning the entire banking apparatus into state snoops, basically, everyone just went, absolutely not. We're not having that. There, I mean, there was this massive letter writing campaign, and that legislation died in vitro. It never even saw the light of day. 2001, there's terrorist attacks. And sure enough, these guys went, hey, this might be a good time to just slip all of those rules verbatim, the same thing that everyone shot down just 3 years earlier. And no one said a peep. You know, I mean, they just went, oh, okay, yeah, whatever, terrorist attacks. And they were scared enough that they let that crisis, you know, they utilized that crisis to put these rules forth. And what they've become is like this way to try and pin you down. But meanwhile, as you pointed out, the compliance departments are just, it's a joke. Like, you know, they just hire more compliance people, and they just say, and like you said, it's just tick box. They go, hey, this is what this is. We did this. This is why we're in compliance. Despite the fact that we let $4 billion of money laundering occur in our facility, we did everything we possibly could. But the core premise of anti-money laundering is ridiculous on its face. It's essentially, they've created a law to make it illegal to commit crime. And if that would work, then they could have just outlawed crime a long time ago. But obviously that's a profoundly stupid idea to begin with. So they bury it in a bunch of like this weird esoteric language. And if you start parsing through it, it just becomes the most nonsensical sort of exercise. But now it's this Leviathan thing where there's hundreds of thousands of people that are employed by it. So it gets really difficult to extricate it. You know, it is truly like a cancer. And trying to get that cancer out without breaking other things gets problematic. But I mean, this happens throughout the economy, you know.
Hey there, just a quick break and we'll be right back to the show. I wanted to spend a minute sharing with you how the Bitcoin Way helps individuals achieve self-custody and self-sovereignty over their money, their online life, and having a plan B as an individual. The Bitcoin Way can help you properly custody your Bitcoin using only air-gapped, open-source, Bitcoin-only hardware wallets. We help you set up and run your node. It doesn't matter if you're brand new to Bitcoin, if you've been in Bitcoin 10 years, there's a good chance that there's a gap in your self-custody setup, and we can help resolve that and give you confidence and peace of mind. When it comes to your online life, you are being tracked and watched and spied on by governments, by corporate interests all over the place. We can give you confidence that even logging onto Wi-Fi at your airport or at your local coffee shop, you are protecting yourself and remaining self-sovereign and private. Finally, if you want help adding to your passport repertoire, we've got a citizenship program whereby we establish temporary residency and walk you through the entire process, white glove service, boots on the ground, through citizenship. It is important in a time of crazy economic and political upheaval that you have optionality when it comes to where you're going to live, reside, and spend your life. Check out thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free consult with the team to learn more about our services and understand how we can help you achieve full self-sovereignty. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you've seen those charts of like, you know, the number of doctors has slowly increased over time, but the administrative and, you know, faculty and hospitals and healthcare is just skyrocketed. It's right. Like one of those WTF happened in 1971 charts.
Yeah.
But the same thing is true in, you know, more traditional corporate roles, like, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley, you know, you got a zillion accountants, external auditors, you've got compliance, like my background was data privacy, cybersecurity compliance. And I mean, just teams of people who are thinking right about nothing but how do we check the box on this stuff? Right, and, exactly. And I think that's just the way of that's just the way of government. You know, there are just so many unanticipated consequences to these sorts of requirements. I actually saw Elon Musk. There was a, I guess it was a quote that he had. It was like, the government is the DMV at scale. So ask yourself, how much DMV do you want? Something to that effect. And I feel like this is just it was a great way of summarizing it. And people are so removed from government, especially at a federal level, that they don't realize that it's just the DMV pushing papers, bothering you, taking forever to get things done.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that leads me into my next question. And this is more specific to Bitcoin. In the short term, what do you anticipate government doing with Bitcoin? Do you think we're entering the narrative in politics? Do you think we're beginning in an adoptive phase of Bitcoin, or is the fighting going to continue or tick up with respect to how they approach the topic of Bitcoin?
Well, the title of my book is The Great Realignment, right? And it's my sort of core thesis is that it's almost irrelevant what people decide how they want to try and pursue, whether it's an attack on Bitcoin or not, because the fundamental financial reality, I think, is just going to overwhelm it. And much like an antibody sort of coursing through the system, right now, like the analogy I make is like if you think about the national economy or the global economy as a body, there are economically important actors within that sphere, right? Like if you talk about a municipality or a county government, a state government, a large corporation, an insurance fund, any of those things, those people, there's a relatively small number of people that make decisions that have an outsized impact on hundreds, thousands, millions of people at times, right? And then there's the rest of us that are making those individual economic decisions. And I kind of equate them to like muscle cells or skeletal cells or, you know, fat cells or something like that. So if you damage, say, like 100,000 muscle cells, the system is fine. It's called a bruise, right? And you just kind of keep going. But if you damage some part of the kidney, it's a big problem. And so right now, what I think the Bitcoin antibody is doing is it's going through and it's repairing all the muscle cells, it's repairing the skeletal cells, and it's starting to get to work on the organs of the state apparatus, the global economic apparatus, things like that, the global economic corporeal being. And I think as those organs heal, it leads to more healing. It's just like when, you know, if you get the flu and then the antibodies start going around, you kind of feel crummy at first. And then sooner or later, you might even get worse over the next couple of days. The fever comes out, your, you know, nose is running. But that's the antibodies at work right now. And I think right now those antibodies are at work. And I think they've been working diligently. And people kind of look around at the landscape and go, oh my God, we're dying. But it's just like when you were 8 years old and the first time you got the flu, you were probably sitting there. It's like, oh my God, this is never going to go. I'm never going to feel better again. And, you know, the people that have a little more experience with it just go, oh, just give it a second. You'll be fine. Just wait for the fever to break, get some sleep, and, you know, everything will be fine. And so right now the global economy is kind of like that adult body that has to keep going to work. Like they don't get to just take a nap and, you know, let the healing begin. So they have to extend the sort of healing process a little bit because they can't just, you know, check out and not do anything. But the healing is occurring right now. And as more and more of these organs become inoculated with this Bitcoin thing, like Michael Saylor's MicroStrategy is one big thing, but the Wisconsin Pension Fund is also a huge thing that people are adopting. That the University of Austin, Texas, I think, has got this now as a reserve asset for their endowment fund. But as more and more of these things, as the healing begins in those entities, other organs are going to start going, hey, like, send us some of that antibody too. And I think the way it permeates, it goes much faster than people are anticipating right now. And much like a fever just breaks overnight, you know, that gradually then suddenly thing, there is one day when you got the flu, you just go to bed and you go, oh God, I feel wrecked. And then the next day you just wake up and go, oh, you're not perfect. You might still have a little cough or something like that. But for the most part, the worst of it is behind you. And it's very sudden, you know, because collectively these systems have healed. And as more of the muscle cells are healing from it, as more of the skeletal cells are healing from it, that encourages, you know, the whole system to get up and kind of walk and move around and start shaking off some of this, the bad effects of the cancer and the sort of palliative measures that collectively all these economically important actors have made. And that's kind of how I see Bitcoin unfolding. And I think it's a much more hopeful narrative because there's the idea like smash the state, we're just going to have a Bitcoin standard and everyone's going to, and I go, well, you, when you start talking about like replacing the current system with some new monetary system, that's a seismic shift and that's a titanic change in things. And I equate that to like a very simple solution to an enormously complex problem. And you only need to look at like the Soviet states and, you know, the communist states and go, they went and smashed the state and they said, hey, this is going to be the way we're going to fix the future. And it was just horror and suffering for millions of people. You know, millions of people perished in that titanic shift in economic policy, economic thinking. And for the proponents of the sort of ANCAP theory of things, I go, you don't know what you risk trying to get down that path. And I don't think it's going to come to that. Like this, as I said, Bitcoin is one of the most unique. It is the most unique sort of novel invention in the history of mankind. And the power of that antidote to this system, I think is going to permeate much faster than people realize. And I'm sort of cautiously optimistic about what the world looks like then. I think it's going to be very different than what we're used to. And I think it's going to be a net benefit for all of humanity, not just Bitcoin holders. But I think the downstream effects of this positively impact everyone's life.
Yeah, I like that sort of way of framing it as it, you know, it's going to like trickle through different aspects of culture and politics and find its way around. I think it's Saifedean likens it to gunpowder as well. Like you know, if you chose to continue using gunpowder only for its medicinal purposes, which I think is what it was originally, then you're going to lose. Right. And more and more people are going to wake up to that. I also agree with you. As part of this conversation I was having with my sister last night, I was explaining to her why philosophically, at least, if not practically, I'm an anarcho-capitalist, and I can't rationalize a justification for where you're born dictating how much you have to pay in taxes or, you know, that sort of thing. But she was like, I'm not sure that would be a better world. And I said, well, I'm not saying it. First of all, I'm not saying it's going to be a better world. I just can't come up with a rational justification for government. And secondly, I think that it's one thing if you drop 5,000 people on an island and there's no government, I think they would self-organize pretty effectively because they would rely on each other for survival. If tomorrow we woke up and we just said, no more government in the United States. Yeah. I think it would be absolute, it would be chaos. And, we've come to, you know, rely on these institutions, but I think if we can, and so this is where I'm sort of drawing an analogy to what you've said. If you could piece by piece, begin minimizing the role of the state in our everyday lives, they're out of education, you know, over time, no more social security, no more, you know, fill in the blanks, and you work your way down to something resembling anarcho-capitalism where people over a couple generations say have the opportunity to relearn personal responsibilities, to your point, for incentives to be realigned. I think we end up in a much better place than we are today. Absolutely. So it's sort of the dose makes the poison, and the speed at which that dose is administered is obviously critically important as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I was going through your Twitter feed in anticipation of our discussion, and you've talked a bit about, or at least reshared and commented on, some of these new open source communication protocols playing a role in this, you know, call it a fight or a peaceful revolution, whatever you want. How do you view tools like Nostr? Do you think these are, right now it feels like a very niche group of folks who are on Nostr using some of these decentralized messaging protocols. Do you think that in the near future, that's going to become more mainstream?
Potentially. The trouble with online communication in general, like I too am part of that sort of Nostr migration right now. You know, whenever someone posts their MPUB, but someone, I can't remember which Twitter guy I was following, he said, oh, are we in that phase where we're all going to go to Nostr again and then we'll be back in like a month? And the odd thing about social media that I think gets lost on people a lot is like those engagement algorithms are almost exclusively trained towards disgust, because disgust is that sort of reflexive thing that gets your, you know, that is very, very easy to, it's a very easy button to push to get people to keep coming back and, you know, being miserable and a little bit angry and disgusted with the thing they just saw is the thing that drives engagement. And so when you get to Nostr, that algorithm is not shaping your perceptions, right? So it's not only is it harder because it's an alternative place for people to be interacting, but there is no thing that's sort of driving people towards that engagement. And it's not driving the type of like social influence that you can get by being the best at stoking that rage or, you know, pointing out the injustice or whatever it happens to be. And, you know, it's a very bubble, like social media bubble generating algorithm, whether it's Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, whatever. You almost inevitably get socketed into something just based on your interaction with the platform. And without that sort of driving force behind Nostr, I think it becomes this much more sort of dispersed kind of means of communication. And there was a really interesting study that was done by, I think he's not Stanford, but he wrote a book about success and luck and meritocracies and things like that. And the experiment they had done is they took like 10 songs and they rank ordered them. They said, hey, this is the most popular song. And then here's the next 10 popular songs. Right. And then for another experiment, the other people that came to the website, that order was reversed. And so number 10 became number one and number one became number 10 and sort of down the line. And then they had a third website that some of the visitors would get routed to where there was no rank ordering. They just said, here, pick what your favorite song is from these 10. Right. And so the one where they said, hey, this is the most popular song voted by users so far, that song overwhelmingly was voted by everybody that came along and said, yeah, I like that song too. When they did the reverse order and they said, this is actually the most popular one, overwhelmingly that song got picked as the most popular one. When it came to just pick which one you like, it was just, you know, I mean, it was just a...
All over.
There was just no clear winner in it. And the guy played a clip of the song and it's just the number one song. And it's like this sort of thrash death metal, like scream core kind of thing. I was just like, and you know, for a fact that the people were listening to this, it was because of that hurting sort of mentality. Right. And it was that sort of that pre-setting of expectations. And I think a similar process occurs on Twitter, right. Where people just go, oh, not only is this person popular because they got 160,000 followers or something like that, but they said something that kind of aligns with what I think. And they are saying that they are better at getting that sort of engagement thing going. And so they end up magnifying, they become the most popular thing on Twitter. Doesn't necessarily mean they're saying anything that's worth listening to at the end of the day, right? And especially to your own sort of individual quirks and idiosyncrasies and personality things. And so when you get to Nostr, you find this, you know, like someone, I think a lot of the carryover will come over from the Twitter to the Nostr personalities. But if you look at like the follower count of Lynn Alden on Nostr versus Lynn Alden on Twitter, it's night and day, you know. And Lynn Alden, I think, is a brilliant thinker. And yet, you know, it gets more diffused and more dispersed. So I think it's going to be harder for people to gain that sort of social media credibility in a field like Nostr. But I think in terms of it being a critical communication layer, that is highly likely, especially given the amount of censorship and things like that are coming online right now. So it'll be interesting to see what an actual egalitarian social media network develops like. It may just end up being this sort of like weird, diffuse kind of place where you kind of like the real world, right? Where you don't have 10,000 friends that follow you around and you go, hey, and every time you say something, your 10,000 friends go, yay, you know. But it may be something closer to like what you have as an actual circle of friends and those little sort of tribal communities where you got 150 to 300 people that you all kind of share stuff and things like that. So it may be these sort of micro communities more than these sort of cults of personality that are dominating social media right now. But nevertheless, there's a lot of opportunity for those people to intercommunicate and just the preservation of knowledge. Like when my book is done, the first place I'm going to publish it is on Highlighter. Because I just want that immutable, like, here you go, here's the book. Like, and I'm also trying to strip away some of the ideas, like, I'm just doing this for money. I think what I have to say is important. I want to share it with people. I want to become part of the conversation. And it's not about trying to, you know, cash in on it. It's just like, here, just take it or leave it. If you like it, great. If not, great. But Nostr is an amazing place to do that because I can't get deplatformed. Like, as long as there's a relay open and I can set up my own relay, that thing is permanent. It's out there. And people will be able to, you know, retrieve it, you know, 50 years from now kind of thing, provided Nostr sticks around. But I don't see anything impinging on that. So,
yeah,
I think it's incredibly powerful and something we haven't quite figured out yet.
You're making me wonder. So it feels like, you know, when you start to learn about Bitcoin, you uncover all of these positive externalities that have very little to do with what brought you to Bitcoin, like, balancing energy grids and, bringing energy to rural, remote areas of the world that have access to cheap renewable energy, for example. And it kind of makes me wonder if with Nostr, you know, my view of Nostr and some of these other tools are that it's just censorship resistant, right? Like that's the point. And that's obviously a very important point to your point about censorship. Right. I also wonder though, if there are additional positive externalities then, such as, you're feeding an algorithm on Twitter or Facebook or anywhere. And, it captures you within a bubble, and you end up with what we have in Bitcoin, where a lot of great content, but it's a lot of groupthink too. And, you know, people are cautious to say things that are going to upset, you know, like you have to be a carnivore and you have to be a, you know, what you have to be a anarcho-capitalist. And,
right.
I wonder if Nostr, just by virtue of its decentralization, breaks us free of a bit of that and allows the best thoughts to flourish in a more meaningful way. Is that something that you would maybe anticipate?
I think that's actually a great point. I mean, you know, and as you framed it, I think you've nailed it right on the head, man. I mean, what I kind of envision through this all is like people will continue to be on Twitter and X and Facebook and whatever it is, whatever, you know, media goon empire happens to take over the next time. I don't know. I think what happens with Nostr though, is you have a place for shared reality and ground truth, right? Like I think when someone sees that inflammatory thing right now, their native impulses go, this is you, you know, get really upset and mad and start, you know, whatever flame wars and all this kind of stuff. I think as people become more thoughtful, especially with the advent of AI and this ability to mimic and mock and sort of parrot other personalities, create new personalities, those AI systems are going to have access to these algorithms and know how to push those buttons. And they're not going to necessarily be forthright about what they're trying to do and what they're trying to accomplish. And, you know, people are talking about being able to spin up 1,000 identities and just, you know, copy TikTok and see if you can create an account that gets this kind of engagement, right? And it's going to be this flood of just like, I don't know anything that's real, but you can go to Nostr and go, well, I know that person's real because they can send me a zap. And the only way they can send me a zap is if they own the Bitcoin. And the only way they can own the Bitcoin is if they're this kind of, you know. So it's not to say that you know, an AI actor couldn't mimic some of that stuff, but there's going to be an enormous economic cost to it. Whereas you or I or somebody could potentially validate who they are as a human being. So if you want to get back to ground truth and someone is seeing a bunch of nonsense, and I think sooner or later it's going to reach a saturation point where people just go, I don't believe anything. It's going to be like state media was in East Germany or Russia. Just everyone knows it's BS. Everyone knows it's nonsense. Because right now it's only about 50% of the people realize this stuff is nonsense that we're getting fed. And, you know, even within the Bitcoin bubbles and like you said, the carnivore thing, and you have to be an ANCAP and you have to do this and you have to do that. And someone that comes along and goes, hey, I think trans people have rights, and they just get smoked, you know, and not saying there's any merit to one side or the other. It's just you get socially pressured to conform. Right. Whereas you can go to Nostr and just have a you can get other alternative opinions that aren't filtered, aren't, you know. And so you can start gauging a reality based on a source of ground truth that you can reasonably anticipate isn't connected to an actual human being. It's not a robot. It's not an algorithm-driven sort of engagement tool. It's like, oh, no, these are people. These are what they think. And you can find that information. And it's immutable, or at least theoretically immutable. So, yeah, I think what you said is kind of spot on. And I think there's enormous potential there that hasn't been tapped yet, much like Bitcoin, you know, so.
Yeah, it's like it might just provide the opportunity for something like a more natural discussion, right, done virtually versus, you know, what we experience on traditional platforms today. And I think that's probably the advantage of it being a protocol rather than a platform, of course.
Right.
So looking out over the next 12 to 18 months, what sort of trends are you keeping an eye on when it comes to Bitcoin that maybe others are missing? Any sort of expectations that you have for where Bitcoin's headed here in the short term?
Well, you know, I know, like, I think a lot of people right now, they've been sort of talking about like the 58K and we're stuck in 58K or 60K or something like that. And I think what's going to gradually start happening is, like, when the Fed is effectively pivoted publicly right now, right? And Wall Street has sort of been front running this whole thing since they started raising rates. They knew that the Fed was going to blink before they would, which is why our markets are just skyrocketing. So they've been anticipating the printer coming on, the, you know, rates going back to ZERP and all that kind of stuff. And the thing is, the way they're sort of going to tackle this the next time around, I don't think is necessarily going to follow with the last time. But as Lynn Alden says all the time, you know, nothing stops this train. The fiscal dominance thing is already set in motion, and it's a global phenomenon right now. And so what I think there are two outcomes from this. Either A, we end up in some sort of fiscal crisis that mandates a thing like a CBDC. And when I say a CBDC, I don't mean like, the US dollar coin based on Coinbase or something like that. But I'm saying like a global rebase. And part of that thesis is like all of these central banks have been hoarding gold like crazy since 2008. I think anticipation of a currency crisis of some kind. They just go, this is going to break somehow. The reason banks hoard gold is because that is an asset that they can predicate their new currency on. They can say, oh, our currency is backed by this thing. That's why you should trust it. That's how they reboot their system every single time. Weimar Germany rebooted their system based on gold, not based on, hey, we're just going to create a new paper. All those little ding-dong banana republics that try and reboot their currency with more paper, they just fail, immediately, right? But the countries that reboot based on a gold standard or some variation on a gold standard do so, pretty, well, at least more effectively, and it can be a little more persistent. They inevitably abandon the exchange mechanism and they just go back to pushing out paper. But that's how they get the trust to begin with to reboot the system. And so we may end up in a place where there's this financial crisis that could be in the next 12 to 18 months because the strains on the system right now are extraordinary. And there is that other possibility where more and more economic actors get onto the Bitcoin wagon and they start. The thing that makes Bitcoin unique is it is a very safe place for these inflationary pressures to be shunted off without collapsing the rest of the world's ability to purchase necessary goods and services, right? And so if we can start fixing balance sheets, which I think Bitcoin as a reserve asset or a hoarding asset or a savings asset can do for corporations, municipalities, state governments, whatever, that is the thing that can sort of shift that angle so we don't end up in this financial collapse and calamity and then they try and issue a CBDC. And the thing is, it's if it happens, like if you look at Argentina, for example, or if you look at any of the countries where these currencies have collapsed modernly, what happens is you go down to the bank and you go, hey, I'd like to take out $20, please. And they go, we're closed. You go, well, what do you mean you're closed? And they go, well, you can't. And so they'll go out and they'll throw rocks at the bank and they'll set fire to things and whatnot. And then they sort of let that percolate for a couple of weeks. And then when you go to the grocery store, like all the food has been looted and everything's gone. And then they come along and go, okay, well, we're going to reopen, but you're getting a 10-to-1 haircut. So here's our new currency. Enjoy. This is how you can go buy your food now. And you can complain, but if you're accustomed to living in this world and you're not self-sufficient, you don't know how to grow your own food, you're not living off-grid, you're not this, that, and the other thing, you are beholden to that system. And for most people, after 2 or 3 weeks without electricity and food, they just go, hey, what's the QR code? Just scan that, go get in that line, and I can get my stuff. And that's it. And then you've got the haircut, you've got this whole new monetary system in place, and that's just what we're doing now, right? And if we can avoid that outcome, I think that's the most beneficial thing that we can do. And I think people that are holding Bitcoin are somewhat inoculated to that sort of outcome already. But, we're a few hundred thousand, a million maybe, that are in a position where we might be able to navigate that. And even then, what kind of island are we going to go get on? And if you have the CBDC, then they can cut your off ramps and all that kind of stuff, and they can start imposing capital controls on you. So it gets tricky. But I think the more logical approach for everybody involved, from the central bankers down, is they go, hey, let's not go down that road because it's going to be an absolute nightmare. There's going to be massive conflict and suffering that's going to follow that rebase. And if they can start to see like, oh, hey, the system is actually healing and there is a massive incentive to keep this game going as long as possible. There's a reason they keep kicking this can. There's a reason they keep inflating the shit out of currency. It's because they want to keep the system alive. They all intuitively and natively recognize, like, we do not want to collapse this thing because it's going to be a mess. And if they can get that can kicked just long enough that the Bitcoin cure can start infesting the system, I think, you know, it's like Jeff Booth says, the cost of goods will reduce to the nominal cost of production over time because of technology. I think Bitcoin enables that by making it so people can actually let that technology flourish and they can start fixing their balance sheet. So they're not continually needing to cut costs, continually needing to, you know, lay off workforce, continually needing to centralize. They can start focusing on different things because their balance sheet isn't upside down. They don't need to rely on debt so much. And that's how I think people start divesting themselves of real estate. I think they start divesting themselves of stocks. I think they start divesting themselves of all these monetary premium assets. And those things can gradually come down. But the balance sheets of the companies that are involved continually get to go up anyway, despite the fact that the rest of this stuff is sort of deflating. And that's my long-winded sort of thesis on how Bitcoin fixes this right now.
Yeah, no. So just a couple more questions for you. So we've tried to migrate away from politics, but I'm curious, when you think about your thesis you just outlined, I know there's a lot of political pandering going on to Bitcoiners, and Bitcoiners are rightfully wary of politicians. But do you see the election this November as having any material impact on what you just described? Or, you know, I think the general consensus in our little bubble is it doesn't really matter because they're going to have to print anyway. But, you know, how might a Trump victory versus a Harris victory impact some of the, you know, what you've described here?
I guess I drift most into the camp of like, it won't really matter. I mean, I think a Harris presidency would be catastrophic. I'm pretty confident that most of America can recognize that already, you know, but maybe not. I mean, you never know. And heaven only knows what sort of machinations are going on in the background, where they're going to try and instill that leadership into Washington, D.C. I think it's going to be contentious no matter what happens. Like, there's 50% of the country can't see or are not sharing reality right now. They are seeing completely different, you know, everything. And it's not even so sort of our ground truth has already been fundamentally broken on some level. But in terms of whoever comes to power, they're going to print no matter what. Like, it doesn't matter if it's Trump or Harris, they have to print, because if they don't print, the whole thing falls apart, right? There's like $600 trillion in derivatives that if you start tracing it all the way down to the bottom of the pile, there's no counterparty to that risk. It has to stay inflated. And in the absence of that, the whole thing, you know, pops. So, excuse me, whether or not Harris becomes a person that tries not to pop it, or Trump becomes a person that tries not to pop it, I think net, it'll probably be more beneficial with a Trump presidency than a Harris presidency. And this is coming from a person who was not a big fan of Trump the first time around. I just went, this guy's a disaster. What are you talking? He's a goddamn reality TV star. What the hell do I need? You know? But I think we've had a whole lineage of clowns that have sort of ran through that office over the last 15, 20 years. And yet, you know, now that I'm sort of looking at the way the political winds are shaping, I think on balance, it'll probably be more beneficial to have a Trump presidency, you know, coming online than a Harris one for certain. But ultimately, whether or not, I think neither of these things can impact the antidote that has already been injected into the monetary system through Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin is inevitable. And I think because it's the most rational course of action, whether or not people understand it right now, as time goes on, as more and more people, as there's more and more successes like Michael Saylor, as there are more and more successes like the Wisconsin Pension Fund, as there are more and more successes of all these little small businesses, big businesses, individuals that are adopting Bitcoin as a reserve asset, it becomes indisputable after a while that, hey, this is a better idea than that. And even in the counties I'm in right now, I literally just went to a board meeting. My institution is governed by a board, and I've already put forth like, hey, we might consider having Bitcoin as a reserve asset. It's a steep conversation, but the thing is if the more and more people that are having these discussions, the more and more this is going to permeate, and nothing stops this train as far as I'm concerned. So in the short term, I think maybe the fever will get worse, but I think much sooner than people anticipate, 2 or 3 years from now, 5 years from now, I genuinely believe that we will look back on this time and go, wow, I didn't realize like how nuts we let ourselves get. But man, things are looking pretty good right now. You know, like houses are getting cheaper. I can afford my food and the food quality is better. And, you know, things are just working better regardless of the political people in power, because they're setting policy. They're coming up with rules, but it's all paper. You know, the fundamental property right that is Bitcoin is the game changer. And that's the thing that gives us a very sound rule at the bottom of the resource capture game we're all playing. And it changes it just like if you change the rules of football and made it so there's just one particular rule you can't cheat on. Like you can never cheat on this one rule. It changes the whole game of football fundamentally. You know, it changes the whole game of soccer. If you made it soccer where you can't fake an injury, like it was just some magical force that prevented you from faking an injury, changes the entire game.
Yeah.
If there was some magical force that says you're not allowed to trip somebody, you can't, you know, hit somebody with your elbow or something like that, fundamentally changes the game. And I think Bitcoin is that one rule. You go, well, you can't break this one, and it fundamentally changes the game. So that's where I'm coming from.
I love it. All right, last question for you. This is one I ask everyone more for fun, but what is an unpopular opinion that you hold, and you get bonus points if it offends Bitcoiners?
An unpopular opinion I hold is that these, I think I've been sharing somewhat. I think things like, here's the best one I can come up with. Mm-hmm. People talk about Jekyll Island, you know, the creature from Jekyll Island. I say, I don't think that narrative is correct. I do not think a group of the secret cabal bankers met in secret on this island to concoct a way to dominate the entire financial apparatus by doing the Federal Reserve. I think the Federal Reserve, in fact, I would go so far as to say, I know the Federal Reserve was a very deeply contentious compromise solution that just barely got over the line politically. And any meeting those guys might have had was to say, Jesus Christ, how are we going to get this thing over the line? Because we can't keep doing business the way we have been. So that would be the thing that would probably inflame people.
Yeah, that'll piss some people off. I love it. No, that was a good one. Man, Daniel, this has been a fun conversation. I feel like we could probably cover a lot of topics we didn't get to, but really appreciate your time today. You want to give, do you want to give everyone a handoff where they can find you, learn more about you, follow you online?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find me at Tinmoney TV on Twitter, X, whatever. I would rattle off my MPub on Noster, but I post there probably once a month, so it wouldn't matter much anyway. And you can find me on tinmoney.medium.com. In a couple of weeks, my book should be out, and you'll be able to find that sort of all over the place. But you know, the website I have associated with that isn't quite ready yet, so I won't share that yet. But those two places, Tinmoney TV and tinmoney.medium.com, are the two places. You can actually read most of the book right now. I'm sort of writing it open source, meaning unlike most books where people write it and then they share it with people, like people have been able to watch me write this book from word one to where I'm at right now, which is about 70,000 words in. So
cool.
Yeah, it's been kind of a fun experiment. I was hoping I'd get more feedback from it or something like that, but I thought it would be fun for other writers just to kind of see what the process of writing a book actually looks like and how it changes through time and stuff like that, but it didn't really happen. So, you can go read it right now if you want. It's wide open. And if you have a membership to Medium, you can actually have it played as an audiobook. So,
awesome. Yeah. I'm excited to dig into that. Well, Daniel, thank you so much for the time. We'll talk again soon, I'm sure, but appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. I had a lot of fun. Thank you.
Yeah. Cheers, everyone. And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Keep an eye out for Daniel's book. Go follow him online. Keep up with what he's doing. He's, as I said, a fantastic writer and someone worth watching. And also, if you need help with your Bitcoin self-custody setup, if you need help with your online privacy, mobile privacy, or a Plan B residency to citizenship option, check out the bitcoinway.com/podcast. We'd love to schedule some time to talk to you a bit more about our services and how we help. I think it is evident, if you look at the world around us, these sorts of solutions are becoming more and more critical for everyone. So go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can also follow The Bitcoin Way on X. It's at @thebitcoinway_. You can follow me there as well, @theothermjordan. I would love to hear comments, feedback, suggestions, ideas for additional guests, of course, and appreciate you tuning in as always. Until next time, this is Michael signing off.